Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange Ask the Expert session. Today's topic is WebSphere MQ Failover on Distributed Platforms. My name is Joseph Lam, and this session will give you the opportunity to speak to our panel of experts on a variety of subjects related to today's topic. Moving on to slide number 2. In today's session, we will start off by introducing to you our panel of experts for the day. We will then move on to give you a brief introduction to WebSphere MQ failover on distributed platforms. Next, our panel of experts will answer questions that were pre-submitted to us through email. Then, we will open the lines for live Q&A period. And finally, the session will end with a summary of the session. Moving on to slide number 3. At this time, I would like to introduce to you our panel of experts for today's call. Our panel consists of Barry Robbins, Team Lead, WebSphere MQ Distributed Support.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Barry Robbins. I've been with IBM for 30 years. The last 22 years, I've been doing software support, and for the last 7 years, I've been providing support for WebSphere MQ.
Thank you, Robin. Next, we have Joanna Johnson, WebSphere MQ Distributed Support.
Hello, everybody. My name is Joanna Johnson, and I've been with the team for the last 10 years. And I have been working with WebSphere MQ Level 2 support.
Thank you, Yana. Then we have Tamika Woody, WebSphere MQ System I Windows Support.
Hello, this is Tamika Woody. I have been on the WebSphere MQ Level 2 team for a little over 7 years, and I do support the System I and Windows platforms.
Thank you, Tamika. Next, we have Andrew Swofield, Senior Software Engineer, WebSphere MQ.
Hello, my name is Andrew Schofield, and I'm the High Availability Architect for WebSphere MQ. I've been with IBM for about 20 years.
Thank you, Andrew. Next, we have Jason Admies, Service Architect, WebSphere MQ.
Hi, I'm Jason Edmeads. I'm a service architect for WebSphere MQ, and I've been with IBM for about 18 years, the last 10 of which has been in MQ technical support.
Thank you, Jason. And finally, we have Jonathan Rumsey, Lead System I Developer, WebSphere MQ.
Hello, everybody. I'm John Rumsey. I've worked at IBM since 1999. I've worked in the development team for WebSphere MQ since I've joined the company. I'm responsible for the development of WebSphere MQ on the IBM I platform, and I was part of the team that added the support for multi-instance key managers in version 7.0.1.
Thank you, John. And so before we get to the question and answer period, our panel would like to give you a technical overview of the topic. Moving on to slide number 4, and please go ahead, Barry.
Thank you, Joseph. Today we're going to look at a few questions in the following areas: high availability clustering, multi-instance queue managers, the relative advantages of each, hardware and software requirements, support and management. Platforms covered are, as we show here, the distributed platforms of AIX, HPOS, Linux, Solaris, and Windows, and System I. And with the exception of one pre-submitted client question concerning System Z, we won't be fielding questions on that particular platform. With that, I'd like to go ahead and turn it over to Tamika Woody, who will be handling our first question.
Thank you, Barry. Okay. Our very first question here is, what failover options are available for WebSphere MQ? Joseph, could you please turn to slide 6? The answer to question 1 is there are several options available when you're attempting to configure a failover environment using WebSphere MQ. Some of the failover options are automatic, while others require manual intervention. Also, some failover configurations are features of WebSphere MQ, like WebSphere MQ clusters and backup queue managers. WebCMQ can also use options that are operating system specific, such as the independent auxiliary storage pools that's available on IBM i. There's also PowerHA for AIX. WebSphereMQ is supported on Windows by a third-party product, Microsoft Cluster Server, better known as MSCS. With the release of version 7 of WebSphereMQ, we now have the features of multi-instance queue managers, as well as the ability to automatically reconnect clients and channels if they become unavailable. Joseph, please turn to slide 7. And Barry, will you continue with the presentation, please?
Okay, so question 2, how should I choose between multi-instance queue manager and HA clusters? Move on to floor 8, please. There are a lot of variables that you need to consider, but here are a few of the things that I think are important. Obviously, you want to look at the environmental complexity, connected applications. If you're using WebSphere and DB2, multi-instance is really not the solution for you. That's a better option for HA clusters. Your MQ configuration, if you're doing a lot of various versions of MQ, version 6 and version 7, as you'll see in a later question, some of the problems that you can run into with clustering, you might want to consider HA clustering just to keep it from being overly difficult to manage. IP address, the IP address in multi-instance will change as part of the failover. With HA clustering, the IP address is maintained. Type of failover events are supported. Multi-instance queue manager is very simplistic in that the type of events it can handle are a loss of a queue manager or a loss of the hosting system. If the queue manager becomes unresponsive but is still active in the machine, then multi-instance queue manager will not do a failover. However, HA clustering can detect this hang situation and can perform the failover for you. Multiple failover activity. Multi-instance queue manager, when you failover, you'll have to do some manual intervention to fail back. With HA clusters, you can have it fail over and fail back without operator intervention. Then there's the cost to consider. Cost is an important factor. Multi-instance is part of the WebSphereMQ product. No additional fees. It's very simple to set up. It's not overly difficult to understand and manage, as opposed to HA clusters, which is another product. It requires a little bit better skill. Obviously, additional investment in the actual product. One other item that I wanted to put into the question or to the decision is if you're running with Solaris. Currently, multi-instance is not supported on Solaris because of a NFS version 4 bug in the operating system. So things to consider. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Andrew to take question 3.
Okay, slide 9, please. So question 3, why was MC91 withdrawn and what replaces it? So can I have slide 10 now, please? So MC91 was an MQ support pack which customers used to use for configuring MQ with HA clusters. And it was provided as is. You know, there was no support for it in itself. So if there were mistakes in it, then, you know, customers were responsible for sorting them out and getting their systems running. So with MQ701, we changed the layout of the data on disk for queue managers, and we separated it into node-specific and shared data. And you don't need environment variables and symbolic links and things in order to do that, whereas that's an awful lot of what MC91 was doing. It was dividing the data into node-specific and shared bits and putting pointers, which were represented by symbolic links, between these two so the queue manager didn't really notice. But because that's no longer required in MQ701, most of what MC91 was doing was actually unnecessary. So we would have had to do a significant amount of rework to it, or actually what we did was withdraw it and replace it with something else. So if you want to set up a queue manager with MQ701 or later to use an HA cluster, then make sure you use the -MD option on CreateMQM, and that causes it to put its data in a non-default location. So you can cause it to put its data on a shared file system. So slide 11, please, now. So the remainder of MC91 has been replaced by documentation in the infos in the WebSphereMQ Information Center. So there's a link to the relevant topic. So there are some shell scripts for doing the monitoring and for getting the HA cluster to start and stop the queue manager, and the text of those is included in the Information Center. They've been simplified somewhat from MC91 because there's less work to do, but they're essentially equivalent. So if you're used to MC91, you'll very quickly work out how to use this instead. And chart 12, please. And this table's just for reference. So if you're used to MC91, you can see what the equivalents with MQ701 are. So I'm not going to go through that. That's just for reference. So that's the end of my answer. Over to Jana now for chart 13, please.
The question four is, what should I consider when setting up a multi-instance queue manager within a cluster in a mixed WMQ versions 6 and 7 environment? Can we have the next slide, please? The main thing to consider here is that since IP address is not being carried over during a failover, it may affect a pre-701 queue managers, since their channels would not be able to successfully reconnect to a standby machine once the multi-instance queue manager comes up. That being the case, pre-701 queue manager in a cluster will need a way to be able to connect to a multi-instance queue manager regardless of its current location. And this is something that will be addressed in a further slide. It is obviously not an issue with 701 queue managers since functionality was added to be able to specify multiple hostname or IP addresses in the CONI attribute of a channel. And this is something that can be done for a cluster sender as well as the cluster receiver channels. Pre-701 queue managers do not have this functionality. So having said all that, we do not recommend making a multi-instance queue manager to be a full repository in a cluster. There should be two full repositories in the cluster which are not multi-instance, which will provide redundancy still to all the partial repositories within that cluster in case one of the full repositories become unavailable for whatever reason. Not having a multi-instance full repository queue manager also avoids an issue where pre-701 queue managers would be forced to define two cluster senders to be able to have access to multi-instance full repository. Such a setup may lead to stuck messages on the system cluster transmit queue in case of a failover, and there is still data left in that queue that was supposed to be destined to the previous location. Okay? So, Joseph, can I have slide number 15, please? So what we are recommending to do is to define a listener as a service to start and stop running QLSR as queue manager starts and stops. This avoids an extra work on behalf of the customer, making sure that a listener is running every time. Again, as I just said, define two full repositories within the cluster. Ideally, of course, all cluster queue managers in the cluster that has a multi-instance queue manager should be at 701, but we all know that is not always possible to do. Therefore, in situations where MQ releases are mixed in the cluster, we advise that you run your MI queue manager as a partial repository within a cluster that would listen on port 1414, which is a default, and define a cluster receiver for this multi-instance queue manager with a blank con name. What this will allow a multi-instance queue manager to do is to advertise its current location to each cluster member, allowing them to create appropriate outer-defined cluster sender channels to a multi-instance queue manager, thus facilitating the continuous connection and availability. I have also posted a link to a complete wiki on this topic, so when you guys have a time, feel free to visit the link and review the whole presentation. At this point, I'm going to pass the next question to Barry in slide number 16.
So the question on this slide is, how do we migrate or update MQ in a multi-instance or HA environment? Slide 17, please. To be honest, it's not significantly different than when you want to upgrade or migrate a regular MQ environment. You need to ensure you have a backup, so a tar or a zip or a save F, depending on your platform, or the queue manager is always a good idea. The queue manager data directory as well as the queue manager transaction log directory. These need to be gathered with the queue manager non-operational, as doing this with a live running queue manager could result in an unusable backup. You should also use MS03 to have a configuration of your queue managers available should you need to rebuild them from scratch. Again, standard whether you're doing multi-instance or HA clusters or just a regular MQ environment. So the unique steps would be that you would fail over to the standby node or system. Once it's up and running on the backup, you'd take and update your primary node and system. You'd fall back to your primary node and system, start the queue manager up, make sure everything's up and running and fine. Then you can turn around and update the backup node. It's really, I'm making it sound very simple, but following those primary steps will get you through a migration or upgrade. Moving on to slide 18. So the question is, if we're looking to run share WMQ on a hub for multiple platforms using new capabilities of multi-instance, is it necessary or required to use external NFS storage to meet our HA needs? And if yes, how do you integrate them? So let's move on to slide 19, please. First of all, it's very important to understand that queue manager images or queue manager data files are not shareable. You cannot create an AIX queue manager and have it back up to Linux or to HPUX. We require the MQ levels to be the exact same. The operating system levels should be extremely close to being the same. In fact, it's best that they are the same. Having said that, you can use a single share drive mounted on a pair of systems that are backing up an AIX environment and backing up a Linux environment. External storage is always going to be the best solution because if you're sharing off of one of your two systems that you're using for high availability, then what you could end up with is if you lose the machine, you no longer have backup capability. So, yes, you're better off with external storage. We support NFS version 4 on Unix systems for Linux and AIX and HPUX. For Windows and System I, they expect CIFS. I do not recommend the attempt to try and use a single to do both Windows and Unix and System I. We've not tested that, and I don't believe it would be that simple to do. But once you export the share, the only thing you need to ensure is that you set the security correct, make sure the user IDs and groups match on Unix systems. For Windows systems, it's a little more difficult that you have to take and have a domain controller for both the primary, the backup node, and the shared system. It's a requirement that is strictly unique to that platform and multi-instance. And with that, I'm going to pass off to Jason.
Thank you very much. Moving on to slide 20, please. So the question is, what needs to be changed within the Windows registry to allow the proper startup of the WMQ services on a backup server when manually falling over outside the control of something like MSCS? And there's some more details on that foil. So if you'd like to move on to slide 21, please. There's sort of two parts to the answer to this. MQ version 7.0.1 introduced something called multi-instance support, which is what we're talking about, and that enables both nodes to have the standard MQ service running, and effectively they both start the queue manager. One actually runs it, and the other sits there monitoring it, waiting for a failover event. To achieve that, there's not much administrative overhead, and takeover can happen pretty quickly, but there is the restriction that both machines have to be domain controllers, and that's because of the security and the fact that different machines have different SIDs for the main control group, the local MQM group. Prior to version 7.0.1, if you move on to slide 22, please. Well, sorry, these are still the 7.0.1 instructions. So effectively, one server creates the queue manager on the shared disk, and then it basically copies the definition of the queue manager across to the other node. by displaying it on one node and adding it on the other node. And then both machines can start the queue manager saying that you're prepared to have a standby system, and whichever one starts first will actually come up and running. The second one will sit there monitoring the first one. And effectively, that's a what we would call a normal setup for the multi-instance. And there's no manual registry editing or anything actually required to get that set up. If you move on to slide 23, prior to 701, there's no real supported way to get this kind of failover without using the actual MSCS support. And part of that is because MSCS actually hides some of the complexities of what was actually required to get that failover to occur. For example, we make use of the cluster server ability to mirror registry keys. If you want to try and do it manually, you would have to do the same as the MSCS support actually provides, and that is to mirror manually those three registry keys. And you'd have to do that with MQ, and especially the MSRVM process actually stopped. And then you need to make sure you give the local MQM group full control over all of the files that make up that queue manager before you can start it. And in the end, this pretty much boils down to being very similar to a backup and restore on a different node, other than the fact you're not copying the data. And with that, I'll pass over to Andrew for the next question.
Okay, so this is chart 24 and question 8. Yeah, so the question says, we're running Flare 10.3 on the distributed platform. Is Swayze 11 required to support multi-instance? Also, is it correct to assume that it doesn't work with NFS version 3 due to the auto-locking capabilities enabled by NFS version 4? So, chart number 25. So the answer is no, Swayze 11 is not required to use multi-instance queue managers. If you're going to use NFS version 4, you will at least need Swayze 10. So, Swayze 9 is still supported by MQ version 7. But Swayze 9 doesn't have NFS version 4 support in it, so you'd have to have Swayze 10. With update 3 for Swayze 10, there was a defect introduced into the NFS version 4 server, and you need a kernel patch to get around that. So the information on the patch is on the slide there. Now on to slide 26, please. So it is correct that multi-instance queue managers do not work with NFS version 3, and that's basically due to the locking behavior of NFS version 3. Certain kinds of failure with NFS version 3, the locks would remain held and it wouldn't be possible to have a failover. So we have to have NFS version 4 or a cluster file system. There's no real requirement for NFS, just a file system that is sufficiently capable, and there are several examples. So NFS version 4 has what's called leaf-based locks, and that means if a holder of a lock fails, then the lock is automatically released and someone else get hold of it. And obviously that's important for high availability, because if the active instance fails, then the standby instance needs to be able to get hold of the file locks. So now to chart 27, handing over to John Rumsey.
Thanks, Andrew. Okay, this is a fairly long question, rather detailed, so I'll try and paraphrase it. I have a cluster with a full repository on ZOS, WebSphere MQ version 6 release, so it doesn't have the capabilities of talking to a multi-instance queue manager through the multiple con names, and partial repositories on IBM i at version 7. The partial repositories use a switchable disk pool to move the queue manager between hosts, and our corporate security policy prohibits use of the well-known port number for MQ1414, so we can't use the blank connection name that Jana mentioned in question 4. Do we have to change the connection name of the cluster receiver channels manually to reflect the location of the disk pool, and is a refresh cluster required to make this work? Please move to file number 28. Assuming that there are no immediate plans to bring the full repository on the ZOS system to version 7.0.1, this is recognised as being an issue. Thankfully, there are multiple ways of working around that. I'll mention some of them, but there are more. Certainly, manually altering the connection name, as the question suggested, at the cluster receiver and switchover should work, though a refresh cluster should not be required under normal circumstances. The default channel retriever channel should be able to discover the new address that's been changed. Another alternative is to use cluster resource groups. In the question, it mentioned that the switchover of the independent auxiliary storage pools was occurring. You can use the cluster resource group to also move an IP address with the disks as well. So that's another option to consider on the IBM i platform. Another alternative is to use a host name and to update the DNS entry so that rather than the IP address changing, the host name remains the same and the domain name server gives a different answer. Please move on to foil number 29. Another alternative, again, is to if you can't use Yana's suggestion of the blank con name, you can change the default port for MQ. So in this case, we were unable to use port 1414 because of security requirements. You can change that in the qm.ini to a value other than 1414. That would need to be changed, of course, for every queue manager in the cluster, so that you could leave the connection name blank everywhere, and everywhere that would resolve to something other than 1414. Please move on to foil number 30. Again, another suggestion is that you could use a message exit to alter the connection name. There is a support pack, MR01, that could be used as a basis for writing your own exit to adjust the connection name automatically. The MR01 support pack, as I mentioned, is also useful as connecting pre-version 7.0.1 key managers to multi-instance. So, for example, on HPO VMS, the non-stop server, we don't have the capabilities of connecting in with multiple connection names. You can use the MR01 support pack to do that. Okay, I'd like to hand over to Tamika, question 10. And Tamika will be talking about a question about multiple IP addresses.
Okay. All right, can you move to slide number 31, please? Thank you. Question is it possible to use multiple IP addresses in the con name to connect to a remote queue manager when they are not configured as multi-instance queue managers? Can you please turn to slide 32? The short answer to that question is yes. Whenever you put in multiple IP addresses into the connection name, then when the channel does the automatic retry, it will automatically find the next connection name, and it will attempt to connect. And if it's there, it will connect, and everything will continue to process as normal. Just ensure that when you set up the con name parameter that you separate the connections using a comma as the delimiter, and the field can only hold up to 264 characters in there. Joseph, can you please turn to the slide 33? And Yana, can you continue, please?
Question 11 is, does conname support multiple addresses in WMQ for ZOS? Connames with multiple IP addresses or the host names are supported on ZOS. However, there is a 48-character limit for a conname attribute on the channel. Therefore, long host names may not fit. So a suggested workaround to this is to set up the DNS servers to use the certain host names instead of the long ones. For example, you can put in my server, which would resolve to myserver.location.company.com, or you can simply use an IP address, and that should take care of your problem. And can I have slide 35, please? Question number 12 is, what kind of events cause a client connection to switch from active IP address to another? There are indeed various issues that would cause a queue manager to fail over, in turn causing the client connection to switch to a standby machine. These issues mainly will include any problems that have to do with a long-term connection errors, either due to a network problem or an incorrect configuration. Also, a switch would occur if the manager comes back as either unavailable or unresponsive for whatever reason. There is a multitude of reasons why this could be the case, and will need to be investigated on a case-by-case basis. This is why I am not going to list all of them here. So if you do have such an issue, please do contact IBM Level 2 MQ support, and I will be more than happy to help you out to get to the root cause of your problem. At this point, I'm going to pass to the next question. Question 13, I'm going to pass to Andrew.
Slide 37, please, Ashton. Okay, question 13. I'm running version 6Q managers on each PUX. An HA configuration was done using MC91, using Veritas cluster server. We understand MC91 is fully embedded in MQ7, so how do I migrate my existing version 6Q managers to version 7? Is it possible to continue using existing configuration but still upgrade to version 7? Chart 38, please. When MQ version 7.0 was released, the original version 7, MC91 was upgraded so that you can use the MC91, which we're no longer updating, in its final form to do the migration from version 6 to version 7. I think that's the best option here, is to use the migration instructions in MC91 to get from version 6 to version 7. You can continue to use your MC91 configuration with the current versions of MQ, but you could make things simpler if you set it up like an MQ701, but that isn't actually necessary. You can carry on with it working as you do today. Slide 39, question 14. In the scenario where I create brand new queue managers in version 7, let's say I create them as multi-instance queue managers using the new FANGs documented, my data disk is different than /var, and I understand that MQ will monitor and offline the queue managers as necessary. In case of failover, how will MQ bring the virtual IP and disk online for the second node? Will it have enough permissions to do that, or is it necessary to give root authorities the MQ MID? So, chart 40, please. So this is really getting to some of the reason why multi-instance works as it does, because the queue manager doesn't run with root ID, so it wouldn't have the permission to do some of the operations that an HA cluster can do. So if you're using multi-instance queue managers, the queue manager data is held on network storage, and it's attached to both servers hosting the images of the instances of the queue manager. So the storage doesn't need to be switched between the two machines during the failover. All that happens is the ownership of the files on the storage gets transferred from one instance to the other, and that's done by file locking. So there isn't any need for us to have sufficient authority to switch a disk. Also, a multi-instance queue manager changes IP address when it fails over, so it doesn't have to do any IP address takeover, and it doesn't need permission to do that as a result of that. So that's the end of the answers to the pre-submitted questions. On to chart 41, please, and I expect back to Joseph.
Thank you to our panel of experts for answering the pre-submitted questions. At this point in time, Jackie, we would like to open the lines for live Q&A period.
Franklin Clark, your line is open.
Okay. We are currently migrating from version 6 to version 7. And one of the issues that came up was relative addressing for XSLT and schemers. We had some, I guess, misunderstanding about the use of shared storage and working storage. We're concerned about where will the broker in a multi-instant environment on MQ, and I don't know if it's going to be covered in this topic, will look for the XSLT.
Okay, because this is an MQ talk rather than a message broker talk, we don't have somebody who can answer that as far as I'm aware. But I'm quite happy to take the question offline and get you an answer, but I don't think I can answer it adequately on the call.
Actually, this is Vivek joining. I just joined a little later. Could you please repeat the question about what's your doubt about XSLTs during the migration?
Well, we were having problems with relative addressing, and so we were told that we need to move to absolute addressing for items like XSLT and schemers. And the question is, which directory structure on the multi-instance will the search start?
So whichever is the active broker, that would be the one performing the search for the XSLT, and that should have access to the directory where your style sheets are located.
All right, so is that the define as the dash E on the create broker structure, or is it the environment variable dollar work path?
The work path is obviously different. In this case, it's not the default work path for the multi-instance broker. I'll have to double-check on the dash E option. I can get back to you on that. I'm not 100% sure on the dash E option. I'll have to double-check on that.
Okay. Do you need some contact information?
You can send me a note. It's vgrover@us.ibm.com.
Again?
V as in Victor, Grover, G-R-O-V-E-R, at us.ibm.com. I'll be happy to answer that question for you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Our next question comes from Tom Maurice. Your line is open.
Yeah, good morning. I've encountered a couple of situations with customers where we have two queue managers communicating over standard MCA channels, you know, sender receiver pairs. And in trying to establish an HA sort of capability between them, this is between one company and an external partner, is there a way to configure the channels and transmit queues to allow, say, if a partner's queue manager fails, is there a way to automatically switch to an alternate queue manager, perhaps at a different geographical location, to continue the message flow and have that automatically happen? Is there a method for doing that? And if not currently, are there any plans to incorporate that capability?
Hi, this is John Rumsey. I'll take that question. There is support for sender channels that you can specify multiple addresses for external queue managers. Now, the requirement that you have is that the sender channel needs to be pointing at the same queue manager. So it's really there for support to allow you to use multi-instance queue managers where your IP address might change, but effectively the queue manager and the queue manager data underneath that moves with the key manager. So you can't use a sender channel to specify multiple IP addresses to two separate key managers. It has to be the same key manager. It
has to be the same. Okay. Are there any plans to in the future to add that capability?
Yep. There is an alternative. You can use MQ clustering. With that, you can make sure that the message allow messages to go to different key managers.
This is an external partner that is not part of an internal, you know, our MQ cluster. So, and I don't see any way for us to change that. They would remain outside of the cluster.
You could, of course, set up a second cluster. You could have your own internal cluster and the cluster that talks to your external partners. And those could also overlap.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Our next question comes from James Scurlock. Your line is open.
Thank you. I have a question related to slide 35. My question is the client connection switch, is that only work for multi-instance queue managers? Or can a client, using a channel definition table where there are multiple available candidates for connecting to, can that a failing of the one it's connected to cause it to switch to another one in that list from the CCDT?
Yes, actually, you can use a feature, the client sharing groups, where you can set this up. So you will be able to connect to more than one key manager.
Okay, but it's just, is it true that it just reconnects, or does it also resume where it was if there was an outstanding MQ operation going on, like an MQ, waiting on the MQ get, something like that, or is it just simply reconnect you to the new key manager?
I believe it's going to reconnect you. I will have to follow up on that. If you could send me a note at YanaR, it's YANAR, at us.ibm.com.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. No problem.
Our next question comes from Edward Jankowskis. Your line is open.
Hi, this is also a message broker-related question, but we're wondering that we fail over, we mediate services for Oracle databases now, and do we lose our resources when we fail over, like the JDBC resources, for example, using multi-instance?
So this is Vivek. So this, the question is, would you be able to access those from the secondary node? Or
yes,
so as long as you have the connectivity, you need to have the configuration established, and it should be able to access your Oracle database using the JDBC connectivity. Because the JDBC configuration that you run, you know, all the connection parameters that you have provided on one broker, they will be taken by the secondary broker as well. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Joe Sparacio. Your line is open.
Hi, yes. My question kind of relates to an earlier slide. I think it was question 5. We are currently running an MQ6 environment on a Windows platform, and we're looking to do an upgrade at some point. But recently we tried to do a recovery test where we rebuilt the MQ from scratch and then created the queue managers again. We recovered all the message, the queue manager objects via scripts. But one thing we ran into was in Windows, we discovered that there are some configuration settings that are embedded in the registry, such as max channel. And we've done some research and found that we can modify the max channel settings via scripts, amqmding commands. My question is, are there any other little tricks or registry settings that we should be concerned about when we do recovery such as that?
Hi, it's Jason here. You are correct. I mean, when on the Windows platform, the queue manager data is on disk, but there's some of the configuration information is in the registry. And I think under question 7, under the foils for that, there were some a list of 3 registry trees. And they're the 3 registry trees, really, that are important to take from one machine to another if you're backing up and restoring a particular queue manager. And that's what the MSDS support pack, for example, will migrate back and forwards. Well, it automatically syncs. It sets it up to sync. The status tree is really more a performance enhancement in terms of puts you back to the same kind of memory allocations as you had when you shut down. But the like the queue manager configuration, those ones you should definitely back up and restore.
Okay.
Thank you. Our next question is from Luke Powell. Your line is open.
We're also in the Windows environment, and I just wanted to confirm that if we can't have domain controllers, then there is no way we can make multi-instance queue managers work. I mean, even any kind of workaround, if we had an ID for MQ to run under that was part of a domain group that was a member of the local groups, there's no way to get around the domain controller issue.
It's Jason here again. Our current position is literally, officially, you cannot do that. The problem with not running on domain controllers, it's not the actual domain ID that everything runs under. It literally is the fact that when we create an item on disk, we grant authorization to the local MQM group. So on non-domain controllers, the local MQM group is a different entity on 2 different machines.
Right.
So as it stands today, that's not possible.
So the checks or the authorization to get to the file storage is done at the MQM group level. It's not on the ID at all.
It's more a case of whenever we create anything, I think the ID may or may not be given access, but we add access control lists where we add specific entities, and it's always the local MQM group that is the key thing that's added each time.
Okay. So in order to create an active-passive scenario similar to a multi-instance queue manager, you'd recommend MSDS?
I think if you can't do a domain controller for the multi-instance, as it stands today, I think you'll have to go down the MSDS or set up something like a domainlet, if you can, where you just have a domain just for the multi-instance.
Okay. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Sampas Upu. Your line is open.
you know, when we are using multi-instance queue managers and when we fail over from active instance to standby instance and how to let the applications know that, you know, this queue manager has failed over onto the standby instance, how to wake up these, you know, the application and to read the messages off of those, you know, queues. I'm just looking, you know, the application high availability as well. You know, when we, you know, for some reason, you know, MQ went down on active instance and it, you know, came up on standby instance. But how to let the application know that okay, this, you know, this queue manager is running on standby instance and you guys need to, you know, read the message off of those queues.
Okay, it's Andrew here. So I guess these are standard bound applications, you know, server applications. Is that correct?
If it is a client application, you know, client, if we are using CCGT, I think, you know, we can fail over, you know, to the standby instance. But if they are using binding mode, how to make it available?
Okay. So we understood that this would be a problem. And really, we expect most people to use client-connected applications for this kind of environment. It is possible to get the queue manager to start applications by defining them as services. But then, of course, they run with queue manager IDs, essentially. So that might be giving them more authority than is required. So that's one of the things you can get an HA cluster to do for you, which you can't with a multi-instance queue manager, is just to start and monitor arbitrary processes. So I think the short answer is I recommend that you use client bindings instead. If you want, you can get the queue manager to start your applications, but that gives them an awful lot of authority, or you could potentially use an HA cluster.
Okay. Thank you for that. And I have one more, you know, I don't know whether it will work or not, but if we use a trigger, you know, if let's say if the message comes on to standby instance and, you know, which is active at the time, and if it triggers the application and, you know, process the messages. But I'm wondering if we are using large messages like, let's say, a bad job and, you know, which is going to be maybe, you know, 20 MB, whether the triggering is going to work or not.
I can't see any reason why it would not.
Okay. Yeah, if trigger is going to work for large messages as well, I think, you know, that's also one more option. I'm just, you know, thinking about it. Thank you.
Yeah, okay.
Our next question comes from Raghu Vanasatham. Your line is open.
Hi. My question is about the failover time from primary to standby from your tests, and how long do you see the queue manager to fail over from primary to standby instance, and what affects this time? Is it based on like the number of logs or number of messages or number of connections?
This is Andrew again. It's very difficult to suggest how quick a failover can be achieved, and it depends on a lot of factors. Initially, there's the time taken to actually realize that a failover is required, you know, to actually register that the active instance has died and get the standby instance to start up. So that can range from a small number of seconds, maybe 2 or 3 seconds, to perhaps 90 seconds, something like that, depending on exactly how the failure is noticed. Because it might be down to the automatic release of the file lock by the file system, and that typically would take, you know, more than 30 seconds, sometimes as long as 90 seconds. Once the file locks have been released and the standby instance gets off the ground, then it has to do all of the queue manager restart processing. So it will have to read in the logs and process the log records to do that. So if there's a lot of processing to do, that can take a while. If it's a queue manager with a large transactional persistent messaging workload, then this part of the recovery can dominate the restart time. So typically I tell people to allow 5 minutes for the whole lot to get off the ground, which is being very pessimistic. But, you know, if you're relying on it being happening in less than 5 minutes, then that's generally going to be okay. You know, if you said, oh, I can get this off the ground in a minute, there are situations where you're going to be disappointed.
It's safe to say that it needs at least 5 minutes when we are talking.
If you allow 5 minutes in your SLAs, then I don't think you'll be disappointed in general. Normally, you can do it in less than that. So, you know, often you'll be up and running within 2 minutes, I imagine, but it depends. If you have a busy queue manager doing lots of transactional work, it might take longer than that.
Okay. Are there any settings that we can do on the NFS mount to release these logs faster or refresh these logs?
There are, on some of the NFS implementations, there are things that you can tune, but I don't have any of the details off the top of my head. So just go and, you know, read the man pages for your particular NFS implementation and see what you can do. But if you tune these numbers down too low, you'll find that potentially you make the file locks be released when they shouldn't. So you might actually cause a failover when one isn't required. So you have to be a bit careful with that kind of thing.
Are there any recommendations from IBM, or is it just left to the OS administrator?
I think it's left to the OS administrator. When we were doing our testing, we didn't change any of the defaults.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from Rajiv Ramuri. Your line is open.
I have a question on the active scenario. I didn't find any documentation in the Info Center.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question, please?
We are trying to achieve an active scenario with, we don't want to use an active standby scenario. We want to use two queue managers in an active scenario. Is it possible, and do we have any documentation?
I'm not quite sure what you mean by active. Do you mean that no matter what happens, you have a queue manager running?
So what we are trying to do is we are trying to have two queue managers to be up always.
Okay, so use two queue managers.
Yeah, two queue managers. So let's say like we have a machine, so we install we create a queue manager on one machine, and we do create another queue manager on another machine, and we make these two as part of the clusters. And if any of these queue manager fails, the backup of the queue manager should run on other server. Is it possible, and do we have any documentation?
So, in terms of when people talk about active, they normally mean, you know, there's a pair of redundant resource managers, and the failure of one can be sort of transparently recovered by the system without any of the applications knowing. So I don't think you can do that with MQ out of the box. If you want to have redundant queue managers in a queue manager cluster and make each of them highly available using either multi-instance or an HA cluster, then you're getting pretty close to continuous availability. If you really want continuous availability, you have to consider the applications as well. And at the highest end, you probably need to start doing things like duplicating all of the messages, sending two of them, so that a failure of anything can be recovered because there's a redundant path through the network. So it really depends how much availability you want and how much you're willing to spend, really.
So IBM recommendation is always use a standby configuration, whatever it is, multi-instance or the HA cluster implementation.
It sounds to me like you probably will be looking at a pair of queue managers in an MQ cluster and then make each of those highly available.
Okay.
Yeah? Okay.
Our next question comes from Alan. Your line is open.
My concern is regarding the performance between the MQ manager, MQ client, and MQ channel regarding the platform, which is AX and Linux. The current situation is we have a single system, which is AX, hosts MQ manager and application together. But we have a plan to try to separate the MQ manager to a new system, which will be Linux system, and keep the application on the current system, which is AX. So the option is we want to move the current queue manager to the new system, then create the MQ client on the current application system. Option two is we create both systems, each has its own MQ manager. So regarding the different platform, which is the Linux for the new system, the current AX system, what's your recommendation like for these two options? Which one will be better for the performance perspective? Because business is most concerned about the near real-time transmission, like the performance. So if we use two queue manager on two system, or we use one queue manager and one queue client on the current application, so what's your recommendation?
This is John here. I guess it really depends on your application workload. We were just discussing that. If you've got effectively a batch workload type environment where you have a large number of messages that need to be transferred from one place to the other, then a queue manager to queue manager, the sender receiver type channels are going to be your best option because they're effectively batching up a number of messages and sending those across in one go. With a client, you obviously have a line turnaround for each message that you're putting from the client. So certainly for real-time traffic, then a client probably is going to be the right solution. For batch workload, then if it falls much in your favor to do a queue manager to queue manager.
Okay, yeah, thank you so much for that.
Our next question comes from Martin Evans. Your line is open.
Hi there. The question is around the services under MQ. I set Message Broker up to run as a service under MQ, and as you said before, it then runs as the MQM user. But if I want to run it as, say, the MQSI user, is there any documentation on how I can perhaps modify the start and stop scripts to do that?
This is Rick again. So the group... There is a requirement for MQM group to have access to the shared work path. You can and there is also a requirement for the user ID to be able to access the shared work path. So from message broker standpoint, those are the two requirements. So you can have MQSI user. You can grant access to MQSI user, but you will also have to grant MQM group access to that shared work path.
Yeah, we've got like several other folders and stuff like that have only got permission for MQSI and no group access. So really we'd like to run the broker as MQSI. So I'm thinking maybe we could use like sudo or something like that in the MQ script, in the service scripts. So it fires off the broker to run as MQSI as we do today. But then we get the benefits of having the broker follow the queue manager as it fails between the instances. I mean, I appreciate, you know, you may not kind of be able to give like full instructions how to do that, but you know, if we could just modify the scripts and just insert our own, say, sudo command in there, that'd probably work for us. I'd need to know which scripts and, you know, whether we can actually modify them or not.
So out of the box, of course, we would not recommend you modifying any scripts. You can, and again, I don't think I'll be able to answer that question. I think this is something I would need to verify with my change team and development. So I would suggest the best course would be to open a PMR and you can certainly assign it to me, and I can move it forward and get the answer back to you.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome.
Our next question is from Sampath Upa. Your line is open.
Yeah, hi guys, this is Sampath again. I have a question on this multi-instance startup. Let's say the server got rebooted, how to implement the startup and shutdown scripts the same? Let's say we got two machines and our client doesn't want to have one machine sitting idle, so that's why we set up, let's say, two queue managers, queue manager one, queue manager two. Queue manager one all the time running on machine one, and queue manager two is active on machine two. And these will fail over onto the other machine, in case of any failure. So we are having two queue managers configured in multi-instance. If something goes wrong with one machine, and both queue managers will be up and running on the other machine and will take the load. But we are not sure how to implement the, startup and shutdown scripts to automatically, come make it up and make it down. Do you recommend anything?
I think that's quite a difficult one to answer because there's nothing in multi-instance that gives you the ability to like have a preferred node or switch back or anything like that. And some of that's provided by the more, what I would call more the hardware HA type solutions, where you can often say this is the preferred node for a queue manager and it will take the ownership of starting and stopping it. I don't think there's anything we provide that would particularly help you there.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
of one question from Caribou Mori. Your line is open.
Hi, guys. So we are planning to upgrade our MQ6O environments to 7. And they are actually VCS clustered, and we are using IBM MC91 agent. Now, the question I have is, those queue managers were created using HACRT MQM, and we have plans to use the new agent provided by Veritas, which is a Veritas agent for MQ. So, in other words, we are planning to replace the MC91 with the Veritas MQM agent. So, are there any special considerations we should be aware of, or any guidance or recommendations from IBM in this regard?
This is Andrew again. I'm not intimately familiar with the content of the Veritas agent for MQ, but, you know, nothing. You can set it up in a similar way to the way you've done previously, so I imagine that it will still just work, or at least be possible to make it to sort of bend things so that they do. But I'm afraid we don't. IBM doesn't take and install the Veritas support and try it out, so we don't really have all that much information on it.
Okay. Now, actually, you know, we tested with a Veritas agent for MQM, you know, on an upgraded version of Queue Managers.
Yeah.
The failover recovery, everything, you know, seems to be fine. Now, with respect to the like conversion that MQ7 makes, like node specific data and then the application, my question is like, should we be aware of any things of that kind? Like, because those queue managers, my only concern was those queue managers were created using HACRT MQM, which in turn uses a lot of symbolic links, you know, here and there, pointing to the HA file system. So MQ7, or will it take care of all these things? You know, the upgrade itself, will it take care of these things?
Yes, I believe it will. The changes that we made for the file system structure were sort of an addition. So we've got a new queue manager attribute called, or a new any file attribute anyway, called data path. And if the queue manager doesn't have a data path, then it continues to use the old model where it had a log path and a prefix. And the way that it used to be set up was the prefix pointed to generally var MQM, and var MQM contained symbolic links up to the shared file system. But the queue manager thought it was using var MQM, and that continues to work nowadays. If you create a queue manager without having a data path, then that will still work.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Our next question comes from Ralph Jones. Your line is open.
Is it possible to repeat the choices, I mean the options of choosing between when to use HA and multi-instance? I thought you had said something like that multi-instance was unable to detect, like if a queue manager is unresponsive or that sort of thing.
That's correct. If the queue manager is hung and maintains a lock and the processes are still active, then there's no detection. You know, multi-instance is basically sitting waiting to acquire locks on the queue manager files. So if it stalls, if the queue manager hangs, if it goes into a non-responsive state, you're going to have to manually intervene with it. Whereas when you're dealing with HA clusters, they're constantly trying to communicate with the queue manager as part of their normal monitoring process. So the moment they can't communicate, they say, well, you're still there, but you're not responding. I'm going to force you down. I'm going to force a failover. So that's definitely a big difference between the two products.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. We have no more questions.
Thank you, Jackie. And thank you, everyone, for your participation in the live Q&A period. At this point in time, I would like to move on to slide number 43 and pass the presentation back to Barry for a summary of today's session.
Thank you, Joseph. I appreciate everyone's questions on this. Today we've answered questions covering the failover options for Western MQ and distributed platforms. Just want to let you know this is the sixth presentation we've done covering high availability options and features within WMQ in the last 2 years. It shows how great an interest this subject is to our customer base. With that, I'm going to turn it back over to Joseph.
Thank you, Barry, for a great summary. At this point in time, we will conclude the Ask the Expert session.